Hello everyone, Paul here. Just wanted to give a bit of a content warning before we begin. The comic that we discuss today deals with extreme violence, self-harm, and sexual assault, sometimes in a pretty graphic and disturbing way. So consider yourself warned.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book
What are we?
A comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Rees.
Here I am.
There you are, sir.
Here we are now. Entertain us. I'm feeling very emo today.
Oh, yes. I am feeling just...
I feel like I just want to, like... I want to talk about my feelings, and I want to talk about them in a very... purpley prose kind of way.
I am currently sitting on the floor in an empty room with the lights out.
Do you have a candle burning?
I have a candle burning and several Polaroids splashed out on the floor.
Maybe some patchouli or sandalwood, whichever your choice is.
I like a little sandalwood. Having been a person who followed the Grateful Dead, I've had enough patchouli in my life. I don't need any more. I'm good. Anywho, as it may have been inferred by us, we are going to be reading The Crow, which is a very, very deep book.
Yeah, deep.
We'll get to that eventually. But first, in the news these days, Roy Thomas is being a bit of an ass.
Just a bit.
Yeah, which is kind of a bummer. So at the time of this recording, last week, Deadpool and Wolverine was released to, I don't know, all kinds of acclaim, I guess. Marvel's back, baby, and all that.
Right.
You know?
Every time Deadpool drops, it's like Marvel's back, because every damn Dreadpool.
I like that.
I would read, well, that's common, you know, because we already have Helverine and whatever else. So, you know, Dreadpool has to be somewhere in the pipeline. But every time a Deadpool movie comes out, it's always fun. I haven't seen it yet. I'll probably wait till it streams. I'm looking forward to it, so I will not say disparaging things about the Deadpool movies, because they entertain me greatly. I am entertained, am I not?
There you go. It is fun. I did go and see it. I saw a matinee of Deadpool and Wolverine, which just seemed weird. Yeah, no, it's fun. It's a fun movie. There's lots of neat cameos, and there's a couple of laugh out loud moments. There's enough jokes in it that even the ones that don't land, there's going to be one right after it that actually is kind of funny.
Right.
I still have to say, and this is not a spoiler in any way, Deadpool and Wolverine are, it's actually in the trailer, Deadpool and Wolverine are walking down the street and they pass a shoe store called Liefeld's Only Feet.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Oh, I'm sold already.
Yes.
If that's all that ever happened in the movie, then we're comedy gold already.
Exactly. No, it's a fun movie. I think I said this to you. As a one-shot, very humorous, very good. If they continue to do movies like this, it's going to get boring and old.
At some point, but they space it out enough, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's not like they're doing a new Deadpool every year, which, you know. And the fact that Hugh Jackman and Ryan Reynolds are pals and have a sense of humor about all this, not just while doing the movie, but poking each other on social media at various times.
Yes, and they've been doing interviews together, and it's all very fun and lots of camaraderie.
Mm-hmm. The elephant in the room.
If you watch closely at the end credits, you'll see it says Wolverine created by, and a name has been added to that list.
Mm-hmm. At the end.
So it actually says, created by Len Wein, Herb Trimpe, and John Romita Jr.,
mm-hmm.
and Roy Thomas. It's a point of contention among many people.
Yes.
That Roy
among
Thomas.
People.
Yeah. Roy Thomas was the editor-in-chief, and he claims that it was his idea that he pitched to these other creators, who then just sort of fleshed it out.
Mm-hmm. And he has a whole editorial on Hollywood Reporter, who should never have published it to begin with.
No.
Where he claims he should have been first.
Well, and you know, this is it's kind of shitty. He makes starts making these claims now that the other people in that list are no longer with us.
Yep. And there's your sign.
Yes.
Everybody's probably least favorite redneck comedian.
Oh no. There's others. okay, so Brian, if I were to say to you, I think you should write a novel about the Chicago music scene. Mm-hmm. And then you went out and actually wrote a novel about the Chicago music scene. I can then come back and say, I wrote that novel.
Or you get top credit for it.
Exactly.
Right. Which, I do the work, but because you mentioned in passing.
I threw out an idea. It's a shame because I have so many fond memories of Roy Thomas's work.
Yes. As a writer, I mean, he's unassailable in, I mean, nobody's unassailable, but I mean, his run on Avengers is one of my favorite runs on Avengers.
Yeah. I mean, he's synonymous with 70s Marvel.
And so many other, but you know, the Avengers is the one that sticks out to me the most because that was some of the first comics I ever read was Roy Thomas's Avengers.
Yeah. So I have a lot of fondness and nostalgia connected with Roy Thomas.
And he actually created lots of characters.
Exactly.
Yes. Lots of them.
There's a lot to give him credit for.
Right.
But I mean, it's just such a cynical play, obviously. This movie is going to make a boatload of money.
Mm-hmm.
Boatload and there's a lot of Disney money behind it. And it's just a cynical play to get an extra payday. And
And as you pointed out, he's doing this while the other folks
are gone.
Yeah. Left the mortal coil.
So there's no pushback on this. Yeah.
And, you know, I read somewhere, someone pointed out, what was that god-awful vampire or the Marvel movie that everybody makes fun of from the past three or four years?
Morbius.
Yeah, Morbius. You know, he was involved with Morbius in some way as an editor-in-chief, right?
Yes.
And he's not running around trying to claim credit for that.
Yes, exactly. He wasn't, you know, jumping up and down going, put my name on this movie.
So I think, like, one of the biggest issues that's coming into play of this is that he's violating what a lot of creators, and my God, the level of creators who have come out. I mean, it's all A-list. Just A-list creator after A-list creator after A-list creator has come out just being like, this is bullshit. Editors do not get creation credits.
Right. And rightfully so.
And if you start doing that, that is a can of worms that is nasty.
Yeah. There's already so many creators who are not getting credit and compensation for the work they have done.
Right.
They don't need someone else stepping in and saying, well, I need some of that because I had a thought once.
Right.
And
as an editor or editor-in-chief, you are being paid a salary to edit. And yes, you do toss around ideas, but the creators create. The editors suggest, the creators create.
Exactly.
And you could argue that editors oftentimes are the enemy. You know, they stomp all over the creatives.
They stifle the creativity rather than enhance it.
There was some dude that actually introduced Wolverine and Foom.
You were mentioning this to me, which I'm unfamiliar with this story.
So, you know, Foom, like, there was a name out there. I didn't do the full research for this because it's minor in some ways. But, you know, it's been suggested that there was a fan who submitted Wolverine to Foom long before this, when Roy Thomas, I believe, was the editor of Foom. Other folks can fact check us here, but you know, the running joke, and it's more a running joke than, but it's like, one could suggest a fan sent in a write-up or a creation of Wolverine for Foom back in whatever year it was, that, you know, if you're going to give credit where credit is, you know, it's...
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, it would be the equivalent of, that's a terrible idea. Hey, I just had an idea.
And then 5 years later, suddenly, oh, what a great idea I just had.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a shame. You know, I understand he wants to get paid. And he does, I mean, Roy Thomas does some good stuff. He distributes the, what is that, the charity for...
Heroes Initiative. He's
Heroes Initiative.
Yeah, the distribution in the Heroes Initiative charity.
which is,
which
you
is
know,
a
admirable
noble,
work.
A noble undertaking. But
I guess good for him. He got a big payday from this. And
but did he? I mean, I don't know how this translated. I, you know, it's,
well, when your name goes up there, you get a little something, something.
You know, I don't know if there's just, if there's fiscal distribution. He is angling for a larger distribution than, say, the widows,
right,
or the families of Len Wein, Herb Trimpe, and John Romita Sr. are getting. And so he's, yeah, essentially trying to cock block his way into like a larger payday than the people who actually did the work.
I may have to edit this, but I may have said John Romita Jr. It was senior. Oh. So ignore me. Anyway.
One of the Romitas.
Yes. Well, if nothing else, I think Roy Thomas will probably get to charge more for his autograph at conventions as the creator of Wolverine. So,
and I don't know his financial situation, to be honest. And, you know, we all want to make more money. I mean, you know, we all want to be secure. We all want whatever. But he was paid a salary, whereas a lot of the creatives were probably paid otherwise.
Yeah.
Per page or per work. So he got his nut then.
Exactly. Very poetically stated. But yeah, it's disappointing. Yes, I understand wanting to get paid, but you don't have to shit on other creators to do that.
Right.
So anyway, Roy Thomas, stop.
Protect your legacy, dude.
Exactly.
Don't waste all of the goodwill. He, I mean, he is known as, some of the criticism of him in the past has been, you know, Stan Lee's biggest cheerleader, but his work as a creator has been well-respected and well-loved by comic book fans, including a lot of the people who are now criticizing him for this move. So protect your legacy. Don't ruin it by going here, but he went here. And so that makes me sad.
Yep, me too. Speaking of being sad, there's something going on at DC. How do you like that transition? No, this is not a sad thing. DC is going to be doing, they're calling it All In.
Well, it's All In and Absolute Universe. And right, they're kind of separate things, but I'm not sure. I'm trying to figure out how this is all going to work. So, well, there's All In. So they're trying, and this is coming in October. And so the All In is in the proper DC universe, where they're kind of changing up creatives on some things, or they're keeping some of the creatives. But the idea is they're launching this idea of first entry.
Right. Soft reboot.
All In is like a first entry. They're saying this is a, we're doing a thing where we're starting stories that will allow people to come in sort of without knowing anything.
Exactly. You know, it feels to me, from my outsider's perspective, that, you know, with James Gunn rebooting the DC film side of things,
yes,
this would be a way for, you know, to get people who are interested in that to jump in to the comic side of things,
right?
Not feel overwhelmed, which is perfectly valid, in my opinion. Yeah,
because, you know, I mean, there's some titles out there that feel so dense and inaccessible. This isn't DC, but I'm going to say, like, Marvel, on the Marvel side, X-Men is completely on, there's, you can't get in. If no. I wanted to start back on X-Men right now, there's no way. I can't. And there are DC titles. This isn't a Marvel issue. This is a DC and Marvel issue. I just use X-Men as an example for me personally, where it's like, I can't, there is no entry point for me at all on X-Men anymore. I can't do it. For some people in DC, there are titles that they feel the same way about, where it's like, I have no entry point. And so I think DC is trying. I don't know if this is going to be, I want to say right off the bat, I don't know if this is going to be successful. I don't know in this day and age that this matters. And I don't know if there is an audience for this. At the same time, it's like, well, you got to try.
Yeah. You know, DC has a history of every few years paring down things and starting over fresh.
Right.
Letting it balloon out of control and then paring it down again.
Right. And I don't think this is it. They're not rebooting anything. This is not a new 52. This isn't a reboot.
Yeah. What was the last one they just did? Recall, or with the Watchmen stuff.
Right. Well, this was a while
Rebirth,
back.
Rebirth.
There's New 52. There's Rebirth. There's a whole bunch of You know, and I do respect the fact that they're not trying to do that. What they're trying to do is they're not changing continuity or rebooting continuity. They are trying to start stories without changing the past. They're just trying to provide an entry point. And with stories that are not completely sunk into continuity. You know, I mean, why not try?
No, I think it's perfectly valid in my opinion. And
I'm just not sure who is looking at this. And like you said, it may be the James Gunn universe. So ideally, the DC movies are going to be way better than they have been.
Fingers crossed.
That remains to be seen. But if there are a few eyes out there who are like, okay, well, I'm going to follow James Gunn from Guardians of the Galaxy to whatever he's doing in the DC universe, oh, maybe I'll try out some of these comics based on, I really don't know. I don't know if it's going to work, but I respect it as a fanboy.
Yes, I do too. And I do. So since James Gunn has taken over, every time there's a trailer for a new movie, at the end of that trailer, they will pop up a list of comics that say, if this interests you, it's based on these comics.
Try this.
Yeah, try this. And I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Because there are people out there going, oh, I like this new Aquaman. Maybe where should I go to read the comics? So giving that crowd, you want new people to be introduced and become invested in comic books.
You have to be, because the most of the readership for comics right now, unless it's manga or manga, everybody corrects me whenever I say it one way, someone corrects me, I say it the other way, someone corrects me. So I don't know. But I mean, that is obviously a huge business right now that is getting the younger audiences reading. But the average readership for probably DC, Marvel, Image is probably people our age.
Yeah. And we're going to be, you know, we're going to be aging out. Yeah. I was going to put it a nicer way, but we're going to be aging out, and we need, where are the gatekeepers of the future? That's what we need.
why not try?
Yes, absolutely.
And if it fails, well, it fails just like so many other initiatives that Marvel and DC have done. And I include Image in that because I think like Boom and Dynamite are active, and some of the other publishers are trying to bring in younger readers. Whereas I feel like I call them the big three. I'm going to include Image as part of the big three at this point.
Absolutely.
And so, which also leads to the Absolute Universe, which is something DC is doing at the same time.
It's the ultimate conclusion for this particular.
It is the Ultimates, but it's not the Ultimates. I understand, like, they both steal from each other. And to just say, oh, DC is only stealing from Marvel is, well, sure they are, but look, to say that and not acknowledge Marvel steals from DC.
All the creators go back and forth to both companies. And, you know, ideas are going to be, look, a lot of what they're dealing with is also archetypes.
Right.
So, yeah, you can just, it's Superman, but something else. It's Batman, but something else.
Longer in the archetypes because they're older. So I don't know. I worry that it's just going to be emo DC, and emo is going to be the word of the day today.
Yeah.
This will be one of 500 times I say the word emo in our discussion today.
I am so interested to see how much more emo Batman can get.
Right. But I mean, look at the list of creators. I mean, so this is Scott Snyder, and right. So this is supposed to be like a separate multiverse or a separate, they're also saying it may have ties to the regular DC universe. I worry that this will get convoluted again, but you have Jason Aaron, Wes Craig, Nick Dragota, Al Ewing, Jeff Lemire, Rafa Sandoval. I mean, Scott's the great Kelly Thompson.
And G. Willow Wilson's going to be doing it. And
you have creators who artists and writers who are amazing, and somehow Scott Snyder has been able to get all these great. I understand Jason Aaron works sometimes better in the more obscure realms, as opposed to his Avengers run was not good.
That's fine. It was fine.
But at the same time, Jason Aaron, we know, can write good comics. I mean, I still think his Ghost Rider run is one of my favorite runs in comics because it was nuts. Absolutely nuts. Getting Al Ewing into the DC realm, fantastic. Getting Kelly Thompson into the DC world is exciting to me. Yep. So Superman looks a little, I don't know, the long hair. Like whenever Superman has long hair.
At least he's not wearing a blue lightning uniform.
Right.
You know,
long hair Superman has never really worked well, but we'll see. Could be an absolute disaster, but with the creatives involved, it has potential.
I mean, to get back to that comparison of the Ultimate Universe, the original, because it's being relaunched now too for Marvel, in the early 2000s, it was a great idea.
Yeah.
Mostly, I don't like it. I mean, there are some takes on the characters that I just thought it was a failure. However, it brought us Miles Morales.
Right.
Which is amazing. You know, and there's a handful of other things in the original Ultimates that have carried over and gone into the main continuity. And it's on the DC thing, it's not dissimilar to like Earth 2.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, a separate continuity. And just let the creators go nuts for a little while and see what they can do. And if it works, awesome. And if it doesn't work, you know, there could be a crisis of some sort.
There will be a crisis about how it doesn't, you know, and it's, of course, they're bringing in Darkseid as the big bad in all of this, which makes sense. I mean, why not? It's like people are like, oh, they always fall back on Darkseid. It's like, well, in Marvel, they always fall back on Doctor Doom.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Like now. Yes.
So, you know, I mean, Darkseid is the Doctor Doom of DC. It's
And Thanos is going, but no, sit down, Thanos. Dr. Doom.
Yeah, Thanos, it's you've run your course. It's like we're back to Doom.
Yes.
And at the end of the day, you know, Batman always falls back on
Joker.
Spider-Man always falls back on, well, I mean, he's got a great rogues gallery, but
But Green Goblin is always
Spider-Man always falls back on Green Goblin. Superman always falls back on Lex Luthor. The X-Men always fall back on, I can't even keep track of their enemies anymore, but it's
essentially Magneto, depending on the day.
Right. And so it is one of those where every superhero has their fallback number one, and every universe has their number one big bad.
Yes.
And I think with the Marvel currently, like as long as I've been reading Marvel, at the end of the day, Doom is the biggest big bad. And in DC, the big bad is Darkseid.
Which is fine. And if it's done well, it's great.
Right. You know, just write good comics. If they're fun comics with new ideas or interesting takes on old ideas.
Right.
I mean, there's only how many actual stories that exist in the world.
There is a number six.
Is it six? Yeah.
I think I could be wrong about that. But.
Yeah. The man versus and the, yeah. So it's what you do within those stories. And as an English major, I should be better at remembering exactly how many stories actually really exist in the world. But it's what you do under the blanket.
It's the motion of the ocean.
It's it's not the meat, it's the motion. So I hope this is successful. If it's not, you know what? I'm not going to be like, oh, DC is the greatest failure that's ever existed in the world, because
it's either the greatest thing ever or the worst thing ever, Brian. There is no in between.
And at some point, right. It's like with the New 52. You know what? There were some good stories. There were some really bad stories.
Nuance is for cowards.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'm actually excited about it. I think, you know, I love a little kind of a reboot jumping on point. Just see where it goes. See what happens.
See what happens. If it doesn't work well.
And you're right. The creative team is just glorious.
It's really an interesting group of creators, and we don't know all of them yet because there's still more to come. You know, I guess Scott Snyder can bring in some talent.
Yeah, his milkshake brings all the creators to the yard.
Yeah.
On that note, let's take a break and just get all gothic.
we're gonna have sads.
Yes. darkness. Enjoy this break.
And we're back. So, Paul, you recommended The Crow today for our discussion enjoyment. Would you like to emotionally tell us about this particular comic book?
I will tell you about this comic. Yes, recommend is a strong word, by the way. Here we go. While reading The Crow, I was reminded of that famous hymn sung by the obscure religious order, Sisters of Mercy. Hey now now, sing this corrosion to me. The goth movement of the 1980s was defined by black clothing, eyeliner, and pain. So much pain. It's a subculture that opens itself up to parody, but to be fair, it did produce a lot of creative and unique works in music and literature, and it did look kind of cool. And nothing epitomizes this aesthetic more than The Crow. Written by James O'Barr and first published in 1989 by Caliber Comics, The Crow was separated into four parts titled Pain, Fear, Irony, and Despair. The plot is relatively simple. After his lover Shelley is attacked and killed by a group of cliches, the protagonist Eric is transformed post-mortem into a supernatural being of sorts and goes on a revenge quest. We are then led through a series of scenes where Eric enacts his vengeance with little to no tension, but depicted in a highly stylized manner. The art can best be described as Frank Miller meets Tom of Finland. Drawn in black and white, the comic is atmospheric, erotic, and brutal. At times it's crude, but it can be beautiful. O'Barr uses dark tones and harsh lighting for the present day and a bright, almost washed out technique for the flashbacks, making the past into a dreamlike otherworld while the present is dim and grimy. Eric is drawn to be sinewy and moves like a dancer, while the villains are lumpy and rough and move with Neanderthal sluggishness. Throughout, the story is peppered with quotes from Rimbaud to Robert Smith. It utilizes religious symbolism and iconography and makes valiant attempts at poetry. The Crow, for all its aspirations, is punching above its weight, trying to be more than what it is, because at its heart, if you strip away all the goth sentimentality, it's a 70s exploitation film, a lurid pulp novel. It's a rape-revenge narrative with stock, depraved villains, and a protagonist pushed beyond his limits and forced to commit horrible acts in the name of love, not to mention a female character who is reduced to simply the inciting incident. But the thing is, you can't strip The Crow from its goth sentimentality. Yes, the story beats themselves have become rote even by the late 80s, but the goth style and the hint of the supernatural is what makes the comic unique and sets it apart from other similar work. And this is the key to its popularity and why it spawned so many adaptations and reimaginings, because like the goth subculture itself, it kind of looks cool. The Crow is a flawed story. It seems to revel in its violence and the depravity of its characters, while it depicts those characters as one-dimensional stereotypes. But in the end, O'Barr does make one salient point, one that, while it doesn't make up for its flaws, it does change how I view the story. Because in the end, there is no catharsis, there is no triumphant victory, no punch-the-air hurrah. It just ends. Because revenge, no matter how justified you think the cause, is not justice. Revenge is carnage. There is no happy ending with revenge. And The Crow seems to know this. So in the end, like the goth movement itself, there is only sadness and pain. So much pain. Brian, what do you think of The Crow?
So much pain.
Yes, indeed.
There was part of me that wanted to go through and look to see how many times the word pain was used.
Don't look, Brian. Don't look.
Don't look. Don't look. Well, gosh. So what is interesting is, as a point of reference, growing up in the 80s, I had my time as a goth lad to the point where I had Robert Smith hair in high school.
Oh, I would have loved to have seen that.
Well, yes, it was, particularly as a redhead.
I know, I was just thinking that, like, a redhead goth? Oh, man.
Yes. No, it did stand out.
And stand up.
So and it stood up. So much hair care product. So I think, there was a point where teenage me in the 80s would have loved this comic. And there was a point in transition into the 90s, which is actually when this was published, when I went from that to more of a trash rock, garage punk, sleaze rock fan, where I would have rejected all of this outright as I developed more cynicism and opted in my writing to remove the word pain from ever showing up. It's my space now as a person in the world had a really hard time taking this comic book seriously in a way that 16-year-old, 17-year-old me would have loved it. So my attempt to remove my current feelings about things, did I love this comic? No, I 2024 me does not. And 2024 me kind of reads this comic with a bit of embarrassment.
Yes. And I want to
Does that make
second.
sense?
No, I want to second everything you just said. So I did not go through my goth phase when I was in high school. When I was in high school, the costume I wore was a hippie boy, tie-dye long hair and friendship bracelets all over. But that being said, I still to this day, and very much back then, was a horror guy, and I still love horror. So
Yes.
things like Bauhaus and that whole goth aesthetic with the, vintage black clothing, and I always thought that was really cool. And okay, I wrote, I pulled something aside. I'm gonna read a passage from The Crow.
Oh, I cited a lot of interesting passages with Crow, but please read the one you have.
But this one, it's right from it's from the very beginning. It says, "Still, so still in the city tonight. 12 o'clock, tick tock, when all that's good slinks away like a beaten dog, and the black shadows are alive with the dead twisted poetry in broken English, flesh and blood, and staring faces." Now, 2024 me knows that's garbage. That's absolute shit.
Terrible.
However, in the 1980s, I would have thought that was the gl most glorious poetry that ever has walked,
Yes,
that ever has been written by a human being.
1988 me would have been like, that's so profound.
I know, man. Oh, he gets it. He gets my soul. And this is where I want to get to with this comic, because we are going to criticize it rightfully for how it depicts things, in reality. But I do want to take just kind of nostalgia goggles this a little bit, because back then it would have played much differently than it does to me now. Like you were like exactly what you were saying. And there are some things we talked about this before we started recording that I do want to try to give this as much of a redemptive reading as I can. And part of that will come from remembering who I was back then and giving it credit for, because this is what not only did this is what I aspired to, but this is how I wrote back then. Because I did, in high school, I tried to be a writer. And this is how I would have written things. So, like I said, it's awful. But I still kind of like it in a weird way.
Which is fine. And again, it's also trying to remember when this was written. And this was the height in some ways. I mean, it may have been the slightly after the peak of goth, but I don't know because goth, like that sort of emo thing kind of continued even with the movement of grunge and the more sort of realistic take on the world and life and feelings and whatever. I mean, that sort of like you had like with the new metal that came in. This is so kind of tied into music. I don't know if this makes sense, but this comic is so tied into and Obar does this like because he's quoting bands, quoting musicians. So like you have the soundtrack of this comic, which you also had in the movie, which I never saw, but I believe I own the Crow soundtrack briefly. So it is tied in with the culture and the music and all the various things sort of surrounding it.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of the comics, this is a comic that is like almost multimedia unintentionally.
Yes, good way to put it. And it is a for all of its flaws, it is a very influential comic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just look at, you know, Sandman. You know, we read the Spectre
right
a year or so ago. There's a lot of this in there.
Yes.
You know, the 80s goth subculture was huge. I mean, it was a big movement. And then it didn't fade away exactly. It just sort of seeped into other things and right. morphed into something else. In the same way punk did, you know, from the 70s into the 80s.
And goth culture still exists.
Oh, yeah.
And it's still a strong subculture. And I don't mean subculture pejoratively. I mean, it's an existing thing, both in writing and film and television shows and music and comics.
You need just go to your teen fiction section of your bookstore and you'll, goth is everywhere. It's right. all over the place. I think it is, as we were talking about, it's a, when you're coming to grips with yourself in your teenage years, you kind of go through the goth phase. So...
Even if you're not goth, you know, a teenager, you go through, every teenager goes through an emo. Well, not maybe not every teenager, but a lot of teenagers go through an emo.
I did, even though I wouldn't have, I was not a goth. I didn't.
You didn't express it in that way. You may not have expressed it publicly, but in your mind, in your, right. It's
Yeah. How I tried to express myself creatively, it was totally goth. Having raised a teenager, she went through her goth phase. And yeah, I think that's just a rite of passage. And no, and I want to say, like, my daughter wasn't wearing black and teased up hair, but she did have her, I'm a dark soul. Yeah, we all want to be Robert Smith and Arthur Rimbaud.
Part of the existential understanding of when we start analyzing ourselves internally and the world around us and trying to understand concepts of spirituality or supernatural, and I don't mean supernatural in like a spooky way, but just in the,
and just roots. Trying to find, you reach a point where you don't fit, you know, you're not an adult, you're not a child, right. you're just sort of like this nebulous thing where, what am I exactly?
You and feel that extant sometimes from those around you, like your peers.
Yeah, you feel out of place and alone, and yeah. you're trying to fit somewhere, and that usually comes out with "I'm all alone." Yeah, and
Crow definitely feeds that sort of feeling. So, as you said, its popularity is tied into that sort of self-involved, and I don't mean, you know, self-involved meaning the understanding of self for people of a particular age. Yeah, it's it feeds into that, and it makes sense just right. how interesting this comic was to a vast majority of people across gender.
Yes, it is a very androgynous, at least the main character is.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, and it is like what I tried to get across in the intro is it's a very typical story. It's one that was like every 70s exploitation film basically is this, except Obar put that goth sentimentality on top of it, that deep dark longing
that you talk about, the 70s exploitation. I would even say 70s blaxploitation, because Obar is visually presenting some blaxploitation which I think he had no business doing.
It's edgy, Brian.
Yeah, well, edgy and gross are separate. They're artistically, there are representations that are not fantastic.
No. And we will, I don't know how deeply we'll get into that.
Or we could just say that and let people know that.
Yeah, there are the way characters, it's almost a caricature. I'm just saying it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
So I don't know how long this discussion
is. The story.
Yeah, I don't know how long this discussion is going to be, because the four issues, there's not a lot of substance. Okay, first of all, let's start out with the first arc, or the first issue, which is, of course, Pain. We start with Pain, Brian. Okay, I will praise it in this one thing. It begins with, well, first of all, you get a little backstory into Eric, the main character, is an undead creature. The supernatural aspect of it isn't really explained.
Not at all.
And I kind of like that. I like the fact that there's just some nebulous Crow kind of reanimating Eric's corpse to enact revenge on the people who killed his, well, wife, let's just say.
Hence the crow.
Hence the crow. But there is a there's kind of like a dream sequence that the first issue starts off with. I kind of think this is brilliant. It's Eric riding on a train and he's watching a beautiful horse run through a field who gets stuck in barbed wire. And then there's a train conductor asking for tickets, but he's a skeleton. And I kind of think this is surreal and awesome. And if the whole comic had been this, mm-hmm. I would have been happy.
Right. And the crow is there too.
And the crow is there.
The conductor, the skeleton conductor, confuses me because they show up occasionally, but I don't quite understand why they keep showing up.
You can interpret that as Eric is being shuffled off to the great beyond, and he keeps refusing not to look. He can't let go. So that's why he has to keep going back to enact his revenge. He has to kill everybody before he can move on. So anyway, I thought that dream sequence was quite well done. And then we move on to the actual story. So the first issue, we get a group of
ne'er-do-wells.
Ne'er-do-wells, there's the word.
I mean, really creative names too. Let's go. I like fantastic naming of these racial stereotypes. T-Bird, Tom-Tom, Top Dollar, Fun Boy, and Tin-Tin.
So I think Fun Boy should be Ton Boy because he doesn't begin with a T.
Fun Boy, by the way, is probably the most interesting character in this entire thing, but we'll get to that.
We'll get to that. Tom-Tom, by the way, can always give you really great directions. We come upon these ne'er-do-wells, one of which is Tin-Tin. So we'll learn this later, but the whole inciting incident is Tin-Tin, Tom-Tom, Top Dollar, T-Bird, and Fun Boy. They attack and rape and kill Shelly, who is Eric's wife.
And Eric is the crow.
And Eric will be the crow. And right. Eric is forced to watch this whole thing before he is killed, but then resurrected by the spirit of the crow.
Yes. So throughout this, it's through flashbacks, Obar introduces very slowly, but you kind of see it coming, Eric and Shelley, this young couple, and goes through sort of the throughout all these issues through flashback. You see their relationship developing and the deep, undying Victorian love that they have for one another.
Yes, it is a very idealized love. And credit to Obar, is that really how it happened? Or is this just Eric's fantasy?
Memory,
his idealized memory of their relationship.
And so, spoiler alert, just to get through, like throughout all the issues, we eventually work up to the fact that Eric proposes. And to celebrate their engagement, they go for a drive, because that's what I would do. And the car breaks down, and so Eric is trying to fix the car, and that's when the ne'er-do-wells pull up. Now this is in the past. These are flashbacks.
Exactly.
And the ne'er-do-wells show up, and they're taking the rock, so they're all high. They're all taking the drug.
They're all high on the crack, man.
They're all high on the crack. So what happens is they end up pulling over. They shoot Eric in the back of the head, and then in a really horrible, horrible, awful, I don't ever want to read this again.
No, it's like a horrible scene.
15-page long rape scene. I'm traumatized by reading.
Yeah, it's Last House on the Left. It's Hills Have Eyes.
It's unnecessary for it to be as long as it is. But that's I'm setting the stage, even though this takes all the issues to fully develop. This is the story behind the story. Right.
Exactly. So and because of his rage and need to get back at the ne'er-do-wells, the spirit of the crow resurrects Eric to go on his mission of vengeance.
Right.
And that's where we follow Eric, who because Shelley, his fiance, has a mask of a clown. Mm-hmm. So he paints himself to look like that.
Or the Joker.
Or the Joker. Could be the Joker. But no.
Goth, he's goth Joker.
No, it's his undying love for his fiance and using her favorite thing. But no, it is the Joker. So yes, so he tries to track down all of these, again, ne'er-do-wells, one by one, starting with Tin-Tin, who the level of depravity that these characters are made out to be is, you know, these go to 11.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. So the first thing we see is Tintin shooting an old lady for no reason.
Right.
All he needed to do was walk up and kick a dog. And then he's like, okay, he's a bad guy. So that way we don't feel bad when the crow shows up and enacts horrible, horrible pain and violence upon him. And that's what we get. And this is where I'm going to say, I don't know how many times we can discuss a scene where the crow shows up. He spouts some ridiculous non sequiturs. Someone tries to shoot him. Nothing happens. And then he tortures and kills somebody.
Right.
That's it.
This is throughout the comic as he takes his revenge. Now, we get some more interesting things happening later in the comic, particularly with the young girl and some other things. And then we learn some connection he has with a police detective and a police officer and some other things. But I mean, most of the first three or four issues is essentially just long fight scenes of the crow just killing everybody while spouting the most absurd and ridiculous purple prose.
And like I said, complete non sequiturs. That's a quote that has nothing to do with what's happening right now, but, you know, I guess it sounds cool.
And at some point, one of the chapters is like titled, like a concave scream. What the living hell is a concave scream?
It's a scream that comes back in on itself, man.
Oh, no, this is just...
He ties shell casings into his hair to represent the people that he's killing.
Right.
The crow, that is, Eric. I do like the fact that, okay, so it's depicted as after Eric does his little, he does a killing spree, and then he comes back to his old home where he and Shelley lived, and he mopes for a bit.
There's this great, and by great, I don't mean great, very obvious scene, like when he's in his old mansion that he bought, creepy old mansion that they bought, where he's just sitting in the window staring at the rain.
And he talks about playing a violin made from my own veins. Like, oh God, oh God, oh God.
Yeah.
And again, though, again, on, I do want to say, teenage me would have said, oh, dude, that is so hardcore.
It's deep.
Yeah. But what I was going to say is that I do like the fact that he keeps trying to dwell on these memories, on these, he keeps trying to go back and he keeps going back and thinking about the attack and letting it eat away at him. I do like that the crow, his little crow buddy, keeps saying, don't look, stop it, move on. You need to move on. There's no way, you can't change the past. You have to move on in order to heal. I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into that, but Obar is doing some interesting things. I don't think he pulls it off. He doesn't pull everything off the way he thinks it's coming off. But anyway, I mean, how far do you want? There are some very iconic panels of like Eric sitting on a ledge outside a window while the bad guys are playing cards inside.
And that's a poster.
Yes.
Yes. It's I know which one you, and you know, he's got the gun
kind of half hanging out of his hand. Like he's just sort of casually, I'm just waiting for the right moment. He's contemplating the violence that he will.
Waiting to. Yeah. And it's Obar like presents it as a pinup basically.
Yeah. That's what you sell at the convention. Yeah.
Yes. That's the print you could buy that Obar would sign.
Exactly. All right. Before we get too far into it, because it's like violence, 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 weird surrealism, violence, violence, violence. That's pretty much the story.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about the art, because I'm of two minds with it. We've already talked about some of the caricatures, the unfortunate depictions.
Yes.
That are in here. But at the same time, like that poster shot, there are things in it that are kind of cool. There is a, you were making fun of it. I can't remember if it was on mic or off, about him dancing. You know, Eric does a little dancing montage.
There's several times that he does little dancing montages.
And I think that's actually depicted really well. It's sort of like this, you know, he's in a depression spiral and he represents that through modern jazz.
Waiting for jazz hands. It's interesting because like you like the art. I don't. I find the art to be not even the bad racial depictions, but just the line work and various things. I found it to be very
high school notebook.
Yes. Or I was going to say indie comics.
Yes, this is. And I think I kind of like it that way because, you know, it has the same aesthetic as early Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in the black and white, you know?
So I think it's basically, you like it, I don't.
And again, I said I'm of two minds on it because there are some panels where I go, what are you thinking about? That is not a human proportion at all. This is an artist who obviously has skill.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is someone who knows what they're doing, but sequential art is hard, man.
It is.
To repeat something over and over and over again is a difficult skill. But there are still, I mean, the contrast, I used Frank Miller as an example. It's the same thing Frank Miller does. Frank Miller does it better. Ooh. But it's that.
Can we put a tag on that so I can?
Frank Miller's art, especially in the early days, I have no problems with. I have nuanced opinions, sir.
Yes,
but no, I you know, it's the harsh shadows and the deep kind of noir type of lighting. I think that's done well.
Yeah, well, this comic definitely. Thank goodness there's not a colorist because that wouldn't work.
No, I agree. The splashes of blood alone would be horrible.
This would be like, you know, Hitchcock refusing to show blood because the horror not showing the blood was worse than the schlock of showing the blood.
But there are some interesting scenes. Like there's a panel where Eric is bent over in sorrow and it's just the light coming through a window and it's mostly black and it's offset kind of on a Dutch angle with clown masks in the background. And it's good. This is good art. And then you get to another panel where it's a racial stereotype and people bending in ways that you're not supposed to bend. And it's like, okay.
Or people's eyes going funny. There's a whole bunch of panels with people's eyes that aren't quite right.
And at the same time, in the flashback dream sequences, it's really kind of beautiful. I mean, some of like the way the crow, the actual crow bird is mm-hmm. depicted has almost like this charcoal rendering to it. I spent this entire comic like going from page to page going, oh, that's beautiful. Oh, what the hell is that? Oh, that's beautiful. So I am of two minds. I think overall, like I said, Obar has talent and knows what he's doing. But this is, as you say, this is a 1980s indie comic and it has that aesthetic to it. So I don't want to dwell too much on some of the earlier killing scenes. It's very repetitive.
If one is really into action in their comics, which is a thing with comics, there's a whole ton of fight scenes.
Yes, but it's kind of the same fight scene
over and over, and it's massive carnage.
There is one bit I will that did amuse me. It's two characters are standing there beating up someone else, and one of the characters says, "Don't lose your head," and then suddenly a object comes from off screen and decapitates one of them.
Yes,
that was funny.
There is a bit of humor sprinkled throughout.
That was clever. But let's skip ahead a little bit to some of the more interesting bits, which I'd like to get your opinion on. But first of all, Eric retrieves from a pawnbroker. By retrieves, I mean he absolutely slaughters the pawnbroker and gets his Shelley's engagement ring back, which he then goes to find Fun Boy. Fun Boy is a junkie and waiting on the steps of his apartment.
It's important to note it's morphine, not heroin. Okay. I have a lot to say about Fun Boy, but let's...
Yeah. Well, good. That's what I went through. But this is where we start to see Eric regain some of his humanity.
Yes.
So there is a young girl, black eye, sitting on the front stoop while his mother is inside with Fun Boy. And her name is Sherry. And Eric has a little tender moment, albeit a little creepy tender moment, but a tender moment nonetheless.
It's a nice moment. I didn't take it as creepy.
Okay, good. Yeah, so he ends up pulling Shelley's ring on a chain and giving it to Sherry.
Sherry's mom is a drug addict who is sleeping with Fun Boy to get drugs.
Exactly.
And so Sherry, the girl who's probably, I don't know, 10, 11, and she's left on the front stoop waiting on her mom. You know, it's like you said, it's a very human moment because we don't know really, we never know what the nature of Eric / the crow is supernaturally. And it's left ambiguous on purpose.
Yes.
Is he dead? Is he not dead? Because he takes a lot of bullets and whatever and doesn't bleed, doesn't die. It is one of those moments where he shows compassion for another human being.
Exactly. So it seems as if he's slowly falling deeper and deeper into this darkness. And this is something that actually pulls him out of it a little bit. So
yes. And we see him later also looking out for her, both himself and in the culmination, he makes sure she is taken care of.
Right. And he does go into, he finds Sherry's mother, who is also an S woman. Her name also begins with S. I think all the women in Eric's life begin with S. And he kind of gives her an out where he says, it's not over yet. You can still, you know, you can still be a family and be
here. You have a responsibility downstairs, you know, be a mother.
And then he says, and this is weird. He says, I have some friends who will escort you out. And there's just a whole shit ton of cats on the stairs.
Right.
So he can control cats.
Right. So, well, and the cats thing is never explicitly explained, but yes. And there is one moment in here where they talk about, like, a woman in the apartment talks about seeing him leave, and she talks about the cats follow. This was earlier.
Right.
And the cats followed him, and they were like, she was like, the cats are following a ghost.
Yeah.
So, and this is playing into the concept of cats seeing things that other creatures. Yeah.
Cats as a familiar and that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah. So it's never explicitly laid out, but his relationship with cats appears several times, not just in the cat, Gabriel, the cat that he.
Yeah. He has a romantic dinner where a cat shows up as well, which sounds strange. Now he lays out a romantic dinner for the anniversary of Eric and Shelley. But anyway, and a cat shows up. This is not a criticism. I kind of like the ambiguity of all this. It's not, the lore is not laid out for us.
Right.
You know, this beat by beat. You just sort of have to use your imagination. It's the supernatural stuff is implied.
Right. Which I actually appreciate. Now, whether that's lazy writing or it's brilliant writing, I don't know.
Yeah. Either way, it comes off well. So let's err on the side of brilliant writing.
It's an aspect that works for me when I was reading this.
Okay, so Eric confronts Fun Boy, jacks him up on morphine. So, okay, I'm intrigued. What are your thoughts on Fun Boy?
So, and this is going to get a little explicit. So trigger warnings, I guess, in effect for anybody. But so Fun Boy is actually the most amoral, monstrous of all of the bad guys in this. Because Fun, like, T-Bird is the big bad that we end up, T-Bird's the one that was the leader of the gang and is the one that...
That's the boss fight at the end.
That's right. T-Bird is going to be the last one that the Crow takes out. But Fun Boy is actually the most intriguing character. And I hesitate to say that because Fun Boy is also the worst of the worst.
He's despicable, and the thing he does is...
The thing he does, and here's your trigger warning, Fun Boy was the last of the rapists, and did his deed after Shelley was dead with basically half her head blown off.
And he said it didn't bother him, he just wanted...
Yeah.
Yeah, and yeah.
And so, but Fun Boy is the one that gets the most mercy from the Crow, in terms of not Sherry or, you know, but of the bad guys. He gets what is closest to mercy.
Does he?
Yeah. This is really an intriguing, and this is the part of it that I actually was like, this is interesting writing, and this is interesting moral equivalency that's going on here.
Okay.
With the other characters, they are presented as having choices in what they do, and that they are bad people by choice. Fun Boy is a monster
by nature.
By nature. And Fun Boy acknowledges that he is a monster, but he also says this is a precursor to what we have now in terms of this concept of people with absolutely no moral compass. Like, there's no moral compass. There are no choices here. They are dead. Literally, you know, dead inside. And their horrificness is hard to quantify because they have no agent. It's the most, I hate to say that the very worst character is the most interesting character, but we have that in literature all the stinking time.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true.
And it's why we read and invest, and there's so many readings into Fun Boy. there's a million different readings, and you and I probably have a very different reading, none of which are positive towards this character. Don't get me wrong here. Funboy is a blank slate of evil without an agent to define the evil.
That's interesting. Again, yeah, you're right. That was not my reading on him. I saw him as a depraved, awful being.
Yes, that he's that. He is absolutely the worst of the worst.
Yeah, and he drugs himself up to either stop himself from doing these things or enabling himself to do.
I don't think there's an enabling one way or the other with him. He is literally nothing. He is nothing but he's off. I mean, it is an intriguing character. I don't find anybody in this story intriguing except for Funboy.
Yeah.
And when I say intriguing, again, do not get me wrong.
Well, it's an interesting thing because Eric at one point says to Funboy, like he doesn't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And he says,
twice,
you know.
Twice he lets Funboy go for narrative reasons I don't quite understand.
Yeah, I mean, there's allusions to Judas and, you know, if T-Bird is the anti-Jesus, Funboy is the Judas giving him up at the garden. But
yeah,
so that's an interesting, you know, a twisted metaphor. But at one point, Eric says to him, I'm not going to kill you. I'm paraphrasing, of course. I'm not going to kill you because when you fight monsters, you can't become the monster. And if I were just to kill you, I would be like you. And I don't want to be you. You know, again, I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
He
also tells Funboy that he's already dead.
I think that's just because of his soul is dead.
Right. There is no soul. There is no soul to Funboy. This is a reference to things that we are now talking about psychologically with people who have absolutely no ethical moral center, and they live in this world without anything.
So basically,
this is before this sort of thing has ever been discussed and has become like you see this when you see, you know, 10-year-olds like killing children, killing other children without any emotion.
Without any remorse.
Not even remorse. Remorse would suggest the possibility of an emotional reaction. And in a comic filled with emo, Funboy is the least emo of all of the characters. He's also the most evil.
Yeah, well, see, that's where I keep falling back on. It's like, he is the most immoral, despicable character of the lot.
But the fact that the crow, that Eric gives him the easiest death and promises him the easiest death.
Yeah, make it quick and painless, is what he says.
Which he does, because he just gives him a morphine overdose. And Funboy is resigned to that. I am not qualified to discuss all of the sort of psychological aspects of this. And I'm not sure that Obar meant for this to be this.
It's interesting you bring that up. I mean, the ramifications of what you're saying is not something I picked up on, if I'll say that. I just saw him as a despicable character who committed a heinous act, and the worst
one could possibly imagine.
And I see it as Eric saying, like, if I stoop to your level, I have lost everything. Whereas the other guys, they're just bad people, and I can shoot them and they're dead. But if I try to, because the other characters, when you look at Tintin and Tom Tom and all that, they're just bad guys who shoot and stab people.
Right.
And Eric kills them the same way they kill others, replicates their atrocity.
But they're all acting with a knowledgeable moral agent.
Whereas if Eric were to become like Funboy, then he has lost whatever is left of his own soul. That's why I saw it as, I will give you this easy death so that I don't become you.
I think you're right. Yeah, I agree with you on that. But I also think that there's a nuance, whether intended or not, that exists there that nobody was talking about in 1990. I don't know how intentional this was, but with a modern reading, let's say a reader response reading, which I generally dislike.
You say that all the time, and yet we do it constantly.
Well, because at some point, reader response exists in every critique, because you're the reader responding to
I don't find reader response to be a bad way of critiquing things, right, so long as you don't get too far into your own opinions. Keep your head out of your ass, and then you can do reader response. Okay. Anyway, we're getting aside.
This, to me, the Crow and Funboy's interaction is the most intriguing part about this comic to me.
Okay. I mean, I found it to be a fascinating character as well. I didn't dive that deep into it. And now that you've brought it up, it makes the comic deeper than I had, that I had on first reading.
This is so weird to say, and people are going to be like, what the hell is wrong with Brian? It's the most intriguing aspect of the comic to me, is how the Crow treats Fun Boy as opposed to everybody else. And again, I have no idea about the intentionality of that.
So after a moment of self-hurting,
and that went on for pages and pages.
It did. And then
God, it just went on forever.
Yeah. So it has a scene of, again, trigger warning, I guess. This is Eric cuts himself.
I made a note of that.
Which is interesting because bullets don't hurt him, but he can hurt himself.
There is a scene earlier where they shoot him in the face and he bleeds.
So inconsistent levels of hurting, mm-hmm, that he can have. But Eric finally does, after some really great modern dance moves, Eric finally decides to break with the past, to let it go. And he burns all his memories and he burns down the house. In a metaphorical moment, he burns away his past, and all he has to do is beat the big bad, which is T-Bird, and he can finally be at rest.
I would like to insert here, and unless you want to talk about it later, him burning down his house also leads to two very nice moments.
Which are?
He saves the cat, Gabriel.
Yes.
Who turns out to be female, and assigns. And so earlier we had a situation with a detective who at the time was Captain Hook, now is Sergeant Hook, who showed sympathy to Eric when he was in the hospital. And he makes sure Gabriel, his pregnant cat, is taken care of by this detective Hook, who showed him a kindness in the past. And he makes sure Sherry is taken care of by another cop that he had interacted with earlier, who apparently he felt was a good cop because of their interaction at a certain point. He does two things when he burns down his house. He takes care of the cat and he makes sure that Sherry is taken care of.
Yes. So he retains. And again, that was the symbolism from before, where he retains his humanity when he meets, yeah, Sherry. You know, he still holds to, he remains human.
And is humanity taking care of the cat? Because, yes, at the end of the day, I'm more concerned about the cat than other humans.
Yes. And it also has another one of those poster moments, the house burning behind him, and Eric is walking away like cool guys do to explosions with a cat on his shoulder. And it's, mm-hmm, like, oh, yep, there's another poster for the convention scene. But yes, we finally get the big confrontation with T-Bird, the big bad.
And that takes forever to get to after all of this.
Yeah, more cutting, more.
We can't even get them into the proper place. It's like he has to like kill a bunch of people in one place and make sure that T-Bird then gets in a car and drives to the place that he needs him to be. The scene of the crime, as it were.
And then this is supposed to be cool. He allows Fun Boy to overdose to, right, his death, mm-hmm, with the words, "I know why Jesus wept, motherfucker," on the wall.
It's just part of the, I didn't want to get into, but the dialogue is terrible. I just have to say the dialogue and all of this is awful. Yeah. It just goes on and on and on for 238 pages that we read of just horrendously bad eighth grade poetry.
Teenage me would have loved this.
Right.
Yeah. Would have been absolutely just thought this was the bee's knees, right, as the kids say. So we get the attack on T-Bird's car because he tries to get them out to the exact spot where, right, Sherry was killed.
And somehow T-Bird went on the wrong road.
Well, it's Eric is manipulating, right, everything. He does the obligatory Christ pose as he's being, right, shot up.
Oh, right. Yes, that was, yes, there was when he first encounters T-Bird has like 15, 20 guys. And they're all, yes, and they just start shooting. And of course, yes, Jesus Christ. Yes,
he does the Jesus pose and then let the carnage ensue. He brutally kills T-Bird's entire crew.
T-Bird runs.
T-Bird runs.
Somehow ends up on the road right where he needs to be by the time the crow shows up in his mysteriously procured vehicle. Huh. And this leads to a very interesting scene.
T-Bird's car is overturned.
Mm-hmm.
He is beaten and he's beat up, I should say. He crawls out of the car and he sits there leaning against the car. And Eric the Crow walks up to him with a hammer.
And then it's what we don't see. Fascinating.
I kind of like this line. It's a very action hero line. How many angels can dance on the head of a pin depends on the tune. It means nothing, but you know, it's kind of a cool thing to say before you kill someone, I guess.
Here's what's interesting. This was his biggest revenge, right? This
right. is the
one. So we have had 220 pages so far of excessive violence. And the moment we get to the revenge, fade to black. We do not see the final revenge.
So this is what I was alluding to when I was in the introduction, mm-hmm. where there is no catharsis. There is no victory for Eric. Mm-hmm. Yes, he kills T-Bird. It's implied that he does that.
We know that he does, yeah.
But we don't get to see it.
We don't see it while we see every other piece of violence.
Right. There is no resolution to this. Mm-hmm. I mean, yes, we get a little epilogue where Eric's
in the graveyard.
In the graveyard, leaning against Shelley's.
And it shows the gun next to him. We know what he does with the gun.
So, I mean, there is that little epilogue, but it's not a happy ending. It's not like, okay, he did it. He avenged his gal. There is just, everything is awful. There is no resolution. There is no happiness. It just is pain and it's over.
Yeah.
And I really like that O'Barr ended it that way. Because there's how many of these stories do you get where they kind of walk off into the sunset and, you know, I'll right. start my life anew now. Now that I've avenged my girl, I can start new. No,
but
I don't
think that was ever the point. He was never going to walk off into the sunset.
I'm glad that it followed through in the way that it did. It's a depressing ending, mm-hmm. and it's a kind of a nihilist ending, but it's the way it should end.
Yeah, no, I think it's one of the moments in the comic where I felt they did that. There are a few times, obviously, as I've said, I think there are a few times in this comic where they did things right, mm-hmm. Narratively. And I think this is one of those because you don't come back from this. You just don't, partly because this is emo stuff and whatever. There's no way you walk off into the sunset to a happy ending. There's no goth happy ending.
Yeah, no, right. Absolutely.
There is, although you could argue that it's a happy ending because he got his revenge and then it's suggested that he moves on and
he and Sherry live happily ever after and in the hereafter.
In the here and now.
Yeah. I don't get that. I mean, I know that he believes that, but I think that all these flashbacks are fantasy and he doesn't, I don't think he gets the happy ending.
Yeah. I mean, but that's the question. How much of this is true and how much of this is in his head? And we're probably reading, I mean, this is the big question. How much of this is true? How much of this is, because Shelley is so much an ideal.
Right. Yeah. She is the fantasy memory. It's how he wants to remember it rather than how it actually happened.
Even as the living without the emo things. I mean, we do that with, let's be honest, exes or whoever else. Like how much of our memory is true and how much of our memory is fabricated to stay with our personal narrative.
Right. Well, we do that constantly on this podcast. When we remember the comic books that we used to read and how it made us feel. Really? Did it?
My next recommendation is based on a memory that I don't, not a spoiler, but maybe my memory isn't as great as I remember it.
Memory forgets and memory rebuilds. That's why we get all these people, like, you know, back in my day, we used to have it so much better. Did you? Did you really? No, you didn't. The past is not preferred. We idealize the past because everything was new and exciting back then.
Fetishize the past.
Exactly. And I think a lot this comic is doing that. This is having Eric fetishizing his relationship in order to make his revenge seem more palatable.
Right. Because there's no way they didn't have an argument. There's no way, like, all of the scenes of them just in bliss.
And bliss and laughing and hugging and
All the flashbacks are in bliss, and that doesn't exist in real life.
yeah, which is why they're all washed out and dreamlike and surreal. Yeah, and it's in that respect. So there are good things in this comic. I don't think it's presented, you know, it's not a masterpiece, but it is something that is it is very much of its time,
Yes.
and it has some very fascinating ideas and interesting changes to a well-worn genre.
It's probably one of the best examples of the time, for good or for ill. It absolutely, as you just said, it exemplifies the snapshot of that time, not just in comics, but in society. And I see why it captured the zeitgeist.
And you can see why people kind of go back to it and want to remake it.
And I see why they made a movie.
So again, time of this recording, we're still a remake of The Crow is going to be released probably in a couple of weeks here. So we're timely.
I don't understand that, but that's none of my damn business.
This has a cult following for sure. And I don't think this is a great comic. I understand why people like it, and it is a, like you said, a snapshot into a certain time and a certain subculture. And it is trying to do interesting things, which I will give it credit for. I would recommend it in the sense that this is something that a lot of current comics play off of, and a lot of comics at the time were kind of cribbing from as well. So it's one of those comics in comic book history where you kind of say, this was important for the moment.
I will state, however, I will always love Robert Smith till the day I die.
There's no cure for that.
There is not.
I'm more of a Peter Murphy fan myself, but hey.
You can't go wrong with Peter Murphy, too.
Okay. All right. So that was The Crow, everybody. Read it at your own risk. So, but Brian, next time
Yes.
on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, what will we be reading?
Oh my God, this is my first recommendation in what, 8 months or however long it's been. I do apologize, folks, for our delay. It was all based on me, not Paul. So I'm happy to be back, and I'm happy to make my first recommendation in forever. Unfortunately, my next recommendation isn't something super exciting, but it's kind of fun. So my next recommendation is the first run of Alpha Flight, Marvel Comics, 1983, 84, somewhere around in there, written and drawn by John Byrne, which we've discussed before. But the first 8 issues of Alpha Flight, neatly collected in, well, let's call it a collected edition. So Canada's favorite superheroes, Alpha Flight, issues 1 through 8, written and drawn by John Byrne.
I'm actually excited about this. I've only read Alpha Flight as a in the periphery.
Right.
I've never sat down and actually read Alpha Flight. So
Right.
it was
Well,
exciting.
it's an intriguing it's also seminal in one certain aspect, which we will discuss.
And it's interesting that John Byrne was the one who spearheaded it, so,
It is.
which we will discuss when we discuss.
Which we will discuss when we discuss, even though we're discussing it.
Yeah, I find this all disgusting. So let's end it there. Thanks everybody for listening. It's good to be back. I hope you're enjoying our episodes. This one got a little heavy. I might even put a little disclaimer in the beginning. But anyway, thanks everybody for listening. Check us out. I don't do Twitter so much anymore, but I'm on Threads and Blue Sky, so you can find me there. And of course, always go to our website, collectededitionpodcast.com. It's a cool looking website. It was built by a really great guy.
I've heard about this cat. I guess he's all right.
Yeah, that's me. Yeah, but so check in next time for Alpha Flight. And until that time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments@collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes